Good afternoon. I'm going to call the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. I'll note for the record that a quorum is present. I'll entertain a motion for approval of the February 13 minutes. Representative Scott, would you entertain?
I will move those minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Scott moves the approval of the minutes for February 13th. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The minutes are approved. Okay, next on the agenda, we have the Office of Higher Education back to do a second part. Thank you so much for bringing the slides to us, and it looks like our technology is working today, so we are very excited. Welcome back to the committee. Commissioner Olson, if you would state your name for the record and continue with the presentation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson, serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And I'm joined today by two of our managers, Megan Fitzgibbon and Megan Flores, and maybe easier just for them to introduce themselves right now for transition purposes through the slides.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. Megan Fitzgibbon from the Office of Higher Education, Manager of Grants and Workforce Initiatives.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Megan Flores, and I serve as the Manager of State Financial Aid Programs.
Great. Thank you. Back to you, Commissioner Olson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just going to kick us off here by saying I really appreciate the opportunity to come back to the committee today to kind of pick up where we left. Just a brief reminder, we did the last time we were here go over through an agency overview, kind of our role and responsibility and authority in terms of programs that we oversee and administer. And then we were able to get through some of our legislatively named grants, and I know the committee's working through a line-by-line spreadsheet, and hopefully this will get into the meat and potatoes a little bit of some of those programs. And Madam Chair, I guess the only question I would have before we dive in is, you know, if you'd like to reserve time for questions at the end and have us get through the material, or take them as they come, no preference from us.
So thank you for that question, Commissioner Olson. We're going to take questions as we go along because we have, at least many of us, have dug pretty deep into the line items, and some of them have got questions that they've kind of gathered throughout that time. So we'll just go as they come. Thank you, Commissioner Olson. Back to you.
All right, thank you. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Megan Fitzgibbon.
Good afternoon, Megan Fitzgibbon, again with the Office of Higher Ed. I'm here to talk about the competitive grants and some other initiatives in our agency. Starting with the Student Parent Support Initiative, this is a new competitive grant program that was enacted in the 2023 legislative session. It provides funds to post-secondary institutions, professional organizations, community-based organizations, and others that help pregnant and parenting students working towards a post-secondary credential. The first round of grants were awarded in last fall. A total of $5.3 million was awarded to 13 organizations across the state. And this program is also administered in partnership with the Department of Health. We have a staff person at our office and at the Department of Health that provides health-related supports for institutions and students. Another competitive grant in our agency is the Spinal Cord Injury and Traumatic Brain Injuries Research Grant. This is a research grant that's been around for several years now. It provides funding for research into new and innovative treatments and rehab efforts for the functional improvement of people with spinal cord and traumatic brain injuries. In the last round, which was last spring and summer, we received 33 proposals. And after competitive review, around 19 projects were awarded, totaling $3 million. I think all but one of those projects has a current grant-funded contract in place already. There are currently, in addition to those 19, 54 active funded research projects. This program has projects that go from anywhere from 2 to 5 years, depending on the type of research that they're doing.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzgibbons. I was just wondering, is this something that you do directly at OHE, or do you have partners outside of OHE that help you to do the grant?
Thank you for the question, Chair and Committee. There is an advisory council that's in statute that supports the work that helps with the competitive review and coordinating the, you know, getting reviewers. But in general, this program is administered directly by the Office of Higher Ed.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Another grant I'm sure many of you, including the Chair, have heard about is the dual training grant. This program has been around again for, 2015, I think it was enacted. It's a program that provides grants to employers to support the related instruction component of a dual training program. Dual training programs are alike to a apprenticeship program where there is a related instruction that's usually provided by a training provider, college, or other type of training provider, and then on-the-job training that is supported by the employer. The grant funds are used for the cost of tuition fees, required and recommended materials, as well as some student supports. The grants are awarded to employers in 7 different industries. 3 of those industries were added in the 2023 legislative session. The first 4 that have been around for quite a long time, advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, information technology, and then the new 3 industries are childcare, transportation, and the legal cannabis industry. In the last round for fiscal year 2024, a total of $5.4 million was awarded to 84 Minnesota employers to fund with an expectation of 958 employees in these industries. Just as a side note, there is additional funds awarded specifically for legal cannabis industry employers. We did hold and publish an RFP for that, but did not receive any applicants, mostly because there just isn't any employers yet that are eligible to apply, or weren't very few at that time. They will be part of the next round. Another new grant at the office is
the
inclusive.
I'm going to pause you just for one second. So sorry. So Representative Knorr has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question about the dual training grants, is that also in conjunction with the Department of Labor Industry?
Madam Chair, Representative Knorr, correct. Yes, the dual training grant is administered in coordination with the pipeline program at the Department of Labor and Industry. Correct.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Thanks. The Inclusive Higher Education Grant, again, is a new grant. It was established in 2023. The program helps awards funds to colleges to help to develop new or enhance existing initiatives with the purpose of increasing overall enrollment and access for students with an intellectual and or developmental disability. The first round of grants were awarded in 2024. We received 3 applications, I believe. Lake Superior College received an award of $200,000. In addition to this program, or in addition to this grant, we also have a legislatively named grant to the Institute on Community Integration at the University of Minnesota for an Inclusive Higher Education Technical Assistance Center. The Technical Assistance Center, you know, given the name, provides technical assistance to colleges in the state, and in addition helps us administer this program in terms of doing evaluation and review at once the grants start operating and things like that. We also have a competitive grant that supports student loan debt counseling in the state. This program has been around for a while. It is established to provide funds to a Minnesota-based nonprofit who specialize in debt counseling, specifically around student loan debt repayment. In this last time that we held a competition for this, OHE received 1 application. It was funded with a grant to Lutheran Social Services. They received $388,000 over the last 2 years, or the last biennium. They do phone counseling, internet-based services, and support, including support around budgeting, debt counseling, credit review, et cetera, and provide that kind of support to 10,000 families annually. Lutheran Social Services is the only grantee that's ever received this grant since it's been since it was enacted, and have continued to provide those services over a number of years.
Thank you. Representative Robbins has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. So I was interested in this grant because I've heard about it before. I think we've had testimony about it in previous years. How many years have they been getting this grant?
Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Thanks, Madam Chair, Representative. The grant was enacted in 2019, so that'd be 6 years at the end of this biennium, the grant. I think previously to that, there may have been a one-time investment that funded, and then it was enacted specifically in statute in 2019.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. And I'm also interested, it seems that over 6 years, word might have gotten out and there might be more than one applicant. How do you do outreach so other people know about it? And do you find it unusual that there's only one applicant year after year?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative, we do outreach like we do other competitive grants. It is, to a certain extent, kind of an odd type of grant that OHE does because it's for a service as opposed to like to a college to do something. But we advertise it as best we can through our communications department with press releases. We try to connect to other organizations that might provide similar services. And that's about all we've done so far. We haven't necessarily heard from other potential applicants for the grant. But they're welcome to, you know, get in contact with us so that we make sure that they get information about it in the future.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad you're doing that outreach because it does strike me as a little odd that after this many years of funding, it doesn't seem very competitive. So I hope that, you know, you'll continue to work on outreach. Thank you.
Great. And Representative Robbins, I would note that from the Fraud Committee, this is one of the organizations that does get money from 10 different state agencies, and there isn't any, you know, communication or look over all of that money. So that would be a broader question as well that maybe your committee could answer as well. Ms. Fitzgibbon. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to ask, what is the base funding for this program, the student loan?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative Knorr, I believe it is the $1 million each year is in the base, but I don't have the spreadsheet in front of me.
I believe Mr. Savory has an answer for that.
Chair and members, based on the appropriation from the previous base, the appropriation is $400,000 for FY26-27, so $200,000 each fiscal year.
I'm sorry. Oh, I just noticed, Chair, that our slide has $1 million, so that would be confusing. Thank you.
Yes, yes, it does. So I'm really glad that our fiscal analyst is right on the ball, as he always is, and has a correction for us. So please continue with your testimony. Thank you.
All right, moving on to the concurrent enrollment grant. This is a grant that provides support for institutions or school districts that have partnerships around either sustaining or expanding existing concurrent enrollment programs or creating new programs or sections. In this last round, the two applications were received and both were funded. One is to Bethel University to support their partnership with Harding High School, where they offer an introduction to healthcare and healthcare careers programming, and another to Central Lakes to support their partnership with the Staples Motley High School, where they offer welding technology and advanced welding, as well as machining 1 and 2. Another grant that is specifically to colleges and universities in Minnesota is the Hunger Free Campus Grant. This grant provides funds to schools to address food insecurity on campuses. There are, in this last round, we had three different grant opportunities. One is a sustaining designation grant. These grants support colleges and universities who have received a hunger-free campus designation and are requesting funds to sustain and continue the work. The Pathways is for colleges that have not received the designation and who want to seek it in the future. And then there was a one-time investment in equipment grant funding that's specifically for colleges and universities to purchase equipment necessary to operate on-campus pantries, food pantries. That one we allowed institutions to apply for both, so they could get a sustaining and an equipment, Pathways and equipment, or just an equipment grant if they needed. In this last round, we had 24 institutions who applied and were awarded. a little under $450,000 for this biennium. And I would also like to add, there is a statute that goes along with this that specifically includes the what is required for hunger-free designation. So that's in statute. We also have the Emergency Assistance for Post-Secondary Students grant, which we call EAPS, because that's a really long term. The EAPS competitive grant funding is awarded to Minnesota private and nonprofit colleges and tribal colleges that have a demonstrable homeless population. We also have legislatively named funds that were awarded to Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota. Both sets provide grant funds to those institutions to meet immediate student needs related to housing, food, transportation, and other needs that would otherwise prevent those students from completing their term or their program. In as of December, there were over 3,300 emergency grants issued to students at Minnesota State, totaling over $2.3 million. 850 emergency grants awarded to students at the University of Minnesota, totaling over $750,000. And we also awarded, actually almost last fall, over $900,000 to 10 private nonprofit colleges and tribal colleges in the state to support their emergency grant programs on campus. Next, we have the Intervention for College Attendance Program, or ICAP. These funds provide grants to colleges, middle and high schools, school districts, and other organizations to provide direct services to students from underserved communities in the sixth through 12th grade, or in addition to their first year of college, to foster post-secondary attendance and retention. They utilize a number of different strategies to do that through mentorship, one-on-one navigation support, career exploration, awareness, academic counselors. Some are summer programs, some are after-school programs, some are camps. They all have different kind of strategies that they do that. In this last biennium, we awarded over $2.7 million to 26 grantees. There was also a special amount of ICAP funds that were set aside as a one-time investment or pilot into ICAP similar programs for formerly incarcerated students. This program awarded $291,000 to institutions and community-based organizations to strengthen support services for students who've been formerly incarcerated. There were four institutions awarded, four grants made for Faribault Public Schools Adult Education, Minneapolis College, Minnesota North, and Minnesota State University Mankato. They use similar strategies, but obviously with an adult population, mentorship, one-on-one counseling, academic support, reintegration services, career exploration, et cetera. We had two legislatively named grants to the tribal colleges in this last biennium. First was the Tribal College Supplemental Assistant Grants, which has a part that's legislatively named and part that's formula funded. There are $1 million in each year awarded to Leech Lake Tribal College, White Earth Tribal and Community College, and Red Lake Nation Tribal College to support their general operations and maintenance expenses. There's additionally $150,000 of this appropriation is used for the existing Tribal College Supplemental Assistant Grant that's a formula-funded grant in statute that helps to provide funding to tribal colleges who provide education to non-beneficiary or non-tribal member students.
So I do have a question about this because we did have the three tribal colleges come and do presentations last week. And Red Lake said that they had gotten nearly all or all of the $2 million of the O&M. Another one said that they hadn't gotten any. So one got all, one got nothing, and the other one got somewhere in between. So between Leech Lake and White Earth, they either got nothing or a little bit. And I'm just wondering why that would be.
Chair, great question. These are legislatively named grants, so we have to, the grantees or the tribal colleges in this case have to provide our agency with the work plan and budget outlining what they're going to do with the funds, which then we incorporate into a grant contract, and we have to go through contract negotiations like we would with any grantee. And for some of those colleges, it took a little bit longer to get that process completed. So some had a longer amount of time to utilize the funds. And then also, in addition, we have grant contracts with all three of the tribal colleges at this time that have been executed. Our agency does, for the most part, work on a reimbursement process. So all of our grantees, or nearly all of our grantees, have to, spend the funds and then request for them to be those expenses to be reimbursed from the agency. So for those that haven't had as much time, they haven't had time to actually incur expenses and send us a reimbursement request.
Thank you. And so are there certain items that are not allowed to be paid for, because it's operations and maintenance, which seems pretty broad, but other things that they're not allowed to use that money for?
Chair, yes, we did, talk. That was part of our negotiations, what was considered operations and maintenance. We utilized statutory language around what's operations and maintenance, and then some of the accounting kind of standards that are around higher education and post-secondary institution. So things like new construction doesn't generally come under operations and maintenance. There are some other things, but for the most part, I think they were all able to find, obviously we have contracts in place. They were all able to find eligible expenses. I'd say the other difficulty was the legislation for this. The appropriations language talked about the funds had to be for not to supplant, mm-hmm. but to support, new. And so I think there was some, we had to kind of work through that and how that would work. So they had to find new things they would spend money on and not things that they had already, planned to spend funds, their own funds on. So, we've gotten through that now.
Okay. And Commissioner Olson, is this something that we, OHE is considering maybe putting into a different fund and operating slightly differently because of kind of how it's worked, or do you have any thoughts about that, Commissioner Olson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And you kind of read my mind there in terms of the comment I was just about to offer. And that is that, although this isn't a budget bill hearing for the governor's budget bill, the governor does actually have a proposal to incorporate this program into the existing Tribal College Supplemental Assistance Grant Program and transition it from a legislatively named grant into a formula-based program. And we've talked with all three of the presidents at the three tribal colleges, as well as their administrators, and all are in agreement that, that would be a more beneficial transition to be able to access the funds more timely. So we're hoping that there's support there. And this is a no-cost proposal, really, and again, something that we feel is not only necessary in terms of, getting the money and meeting the legislative intent, of the funding to them quickly, but also something that'll ease, our work as well as theirs.
And Commissioner Olson, is that, since it's Former Lake, then depending on how many students each of them have, it would be more of a scale depending on, if one's a larger school than the other, or they have a bigger enrollment this year than last year, so it's all formulaic?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that in essence is the change. However, we would, again, to meet the legislative intent of the $1 million, set a floor, a funding floor for those three colleges, and then anything over and above they'd be accessing as part of the $150,000 appropriation in the existing program.
Okay, great. Thanks for all of those answers. I know that those were many of the questions that we had after the hearing with them, so thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none, please continue.
Madam Chair, really quickly.
Commissioner Olson.
Apologies, I'll just take the last line item there on the unemployment insurance aid component, just to say that on behalf of the three tribal colleges that don't operate through a state public system like the University of Minnesota or Minnesota State, the Office of Higher Education on behalf of the three tribal colleges is working on the reimbursement for the unemployment insurance aid component for those three tribal colleges that was passed last year.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson. Ms. Fitzgibbons, please continue.
Moving on to some of our other legislatively named grants, we have two grants, one to United Family Medicine and another to Hennepin Healthcare to support family medicine resident programs. These programs help resident physicians in graduate family medical education programs that address the shortage of family medicine physicians in underserved rural and urban areas of the state. In addition, we have a similar program that funds graduate medical education in addiction medicine that goes to Hennepin Healthcare.
Great. We have a question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, under both of these programs, is there any requirement that the physicians stay in Minnesota for a certain length of time after they receive these funds and after they're licensed?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair and Representative, there isn't in law. We do know from their reports to us that it seems as if their graduates have maintained and stayed in Minnesota, or at least are serving Minnesotans, perhaps in another state in a border area, but they're still serving Minnesotans. But there is no requirement in law that recipients or that participants or they do anything to maintain or to stay in Minnesota.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. Please continue.
We, to finish out our grants, legislatively named and competitive grants, we have a small grant that goes to the Loan Repayment Assistance Program of Minnesota. This is an organization that provides funds to reduce the debt, the student loan debt of public interest lawyers who work and represent low-income clients seeking legal services throughout the state. So it works like other loan repayment programs, even the ones that we have in our agency, where it's a grant to that organization to do that for those specific population.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Since we're kind of to the end of that section, I'd like to go back, if I could, for a minute to the Hunger Free Campus program. And I'm a big supporter of those efforts. But I'm just wondering, lately I've been learning a little more about how we in the state, how our anti-hunger efforts work. And we have both a system that funds food shelves directly, and then we have also food banks. And it's kind of complicated, but the food banks also support food shelves. And so I'm kind of wondering how this works and whether this is the most efficient way to do this, shall we say. Is this then these grants, and I see there are three different types of grants and for kind of different situations, but those are grants that are just, my understanding, right, going right to the institutions, right? And then those institutions have to go out and source the food for the food shelf. Is that kind of how this is working? So I'm wondering whether there's been consideration of working through one of the food banks or working with one of the food banks to get a more, in my understanding, a more efficient distribution, a more cost-effective sourcing of food to go through food shelves. Any comment on that?
Representative Liebling, you are right on the money. I worked close to 15 years in a nonprofit in my community, one of the biggest ones for the food shelf. It was a food shelf. So I'm going to let them answer, but you are right on the money. I have had this exact same thought, too, because there are much more efficient ways to use this money so that the food gets directly to the students. But we'll let them speak. Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative, many of the campuses, including ones that get Hunger Free Campus grants, do have partnerships with food shelves and food banks to either provide access to students for food pantries that are close by campus or actually on campuses, and also to source food and bring it on campus for their on-campus food pantry. These Hunger Free Campus grants fund purchasing of food and other things that are necessary for the food pantries. But also for other types of events and activities that happen in order, like around hunger-free awareness. So making sure students know that they have a food pantry, doing types of events around providing outreach to them, in addition to actually sourcing food and buying things. But yes, they work with the food shelves and food banks if they are available. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just want to say I just toured the local community college not far from my own home, and to see their food pantry, and I was just going to say, it's really important that these pantries are on the campuses, and they are leveraging these dollars in such an incredible way, and to make it so they are working with the food shelves to get that extremely low cost, and even to get additional foods and things that would normally have expired on the food shelves, right? So to make the food available so that students can get the food without any shame or any embarrassment, and they just have to go in with their backpack, put their student number in, get their food, and go. And it really is an incredible program that's working extremely well. So if there are any changes to this program, I think we should be very cautious, and I think that we should do it in consultation with the institutions that are actually using it so that we do no harm, because there's real hunger, there are real physical needs that are being met with these dollars, and we want to make sure that, I think to everybody's point, that we're getting the most bang for our buck, but I think it should be done in consultation with the institutions that are using it. Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we're finishing this up, I had a question about the loan repayment for public interest lawyers on the last one in this section. So you mentioned when you were testifying that the money doesn't really go directly to the students, but it goes to a group. Which group gets this money, and what do they do with it?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative, the organization is called Loan Repayment Assistance Program of Minnesota. I think on the,
right,
it might say LRAP on a lot of things. It's specifically an organization that provides loan repayment for public interest legal aid attorneys that provide services to low-cost, or for low-cost services to low-income clients seeking those services across the state. So they're in the actual organization. It's very confusing, because then the next slide is our loan repayment programs.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, it's an organization that's specifically called Loan Repayment Assistance Program of Minnesota.
Representative Hansen.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Back to Representative Robbins, then to Representative Hansen.
Thank you. So what do they do with the money? Do they actually give out grants to students to pay down their loans, or is this just to fund a position at this organization? What's the money used for?
Chair, Representative, it goes directly to the borrowers. They, from what I remember, they don't use any of the funds for administrative costs. And those borrowers who have their student loans repaid do have service agreements, so they agree to, they've either already served or they agree to serve in those legal aid or low-income client-serving services for X number of years in exchange for the loan repayment that they're receiving. And then those dollars are used directly to buy or to pay down the student loans that they have.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And I was just to jump back to the Hungry Free Campus grants. Two questions. One, is there caps on these for each campus? And second question, are there questions about any conversation about increasing those caps? I'm a Metro State alum, and we know that the Metro State food shelf also supplies the community, not just students. And so just curious, because obviously utilization of this looks like it's a little bit lower, if there's any, if there is caps, and if there's talk about increasing those at all.
Let's skip in.
Chair, Representative, there are caps in the statute, $15,000 for pathways to designation grants, and $25,000 for the sustaining $25,000 for the pathways and $15,000 for the sustaining designation grant. And you're correct, we did see a low number of applicants for this program, some of which would be maybe consistent with not the maxes, but we also based on what we saw in the applications and those that are funded, nearly half didn't request the full maximum that was available to them. So just increasing the maximums may not have that same effect. We did see some large institutions like the University of Minnesota. There was two campuses that applied, but they did not apply for either the sustaining or pathways grant. They only applied for an equipment grant, the one-time funding. Then the other thing that curbed the that limited the amount of funding was in the statute. There is a requirement that private nonprofit institutions can only make up 20% of the total amount of funds awarded. So even though we had ample excess funds available to award, we had to reduce all the awards to the private nonprofit institutions to make sure they got within 20%. The other thing I'd say is that going above for the pathways for $25,000 would bring these grants into a different category, I would say, maybe in competitive grants, in that they would be over $50,000. So the administrative cost to the agency would be different if for those ones that happen to be over $50,000. Again, they may not all request the max, but if they're over $50,000, the agency would have some additional administrative work to do around these grants.
Okay, Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is an important topic for us to explore because according to the annual report for students' basic needs for September 2024, it showed 40% of undergraduate students have good basic needs, food insecurity, housing insecurity, financial insecurity. And we're talking about the programs here, including IPS. And it looks like we had one-time fund to spend more, including the Hunger Free Campus. I just wanted to check, Madam Chair, with nonpartisan Mr. Savory, if he can give us the actual amounts for the Hunger Free Campus and also for the IPS, what is in the base and what has been the normal, so that we can get the picture.
Thank you. Mr. Savory, do you happen to have that right handy?
Just one minute. So, Chair and members, the base for the Hunger Free Campus Act in FY26-27 is $2 million. Mm-hmm. The previous finance bill contained a clause in FY24 that allowed permissive language for up to $500,000 for equipment grants. That was only in the first year of the biennium, so that increase goes down in the second year, and hence why it's $2 million in the FY26-27 moving forward.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. Representative Noor.
Madam Chair, I was also asking for the IPS, which is for the basic needs.
Basic needs?
If we can get.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, the emergency assistance for post-secondary students has a base of $7,158,000 in FY26-27, and that was the same as FY24-25.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Noor.
Appreciate it.
You good? Okay. And Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. You brought up a good point about the legislatively named grants, and there was a great line of discussion. And I just want some clarification. So in legislatively named grants, you have certain oversight requirements. Would you mind running us through what those look like? So when we tell you to give money to A, what do you still have to do, even though we told you to do it?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair and Representative, I like to affectionately say a legislatively named grant is a competitive grant without a competition. So in general, the same requirements for oversight, for practices, for policies apply to a legislatively named grant that apply to a competitive grant, except we don't have to do a competition. So agencies are still required to do pre-award risk assessments, still required to have grant contract agreements that meet all the legislative and Office of Grants Management policies and agency policies, still required to have a work plan and budget, still required to do progress reports, all the same things that you would have to do in a grant life cycle, except you don't have to have a competition because the legislature has said give money to X organization or to these organizations. The only other thing I'd say is that sometimes the either the appropriations or if there's an actual statute to go along with it, the appropriations law also kind of dictates some of that as well. So sometimes it can be very specific and almost be like a formula funded grant, but still the same things apply. Still have to do progress reports, still have to do oversight that you would have to do with any other grant.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. So just one follow-up question. So I imagine that that's a little frustrating for folks that are legislatively named because they think they're named and they're going to get the funds, and then that's not really how that works out in practice, right? So what happens if they are unsuccessful? So they can't get the work plan together, they can't get the budget together, you do the risk assessment and there's concerns. Like, walk me through what that looks like.
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative, that's a great question. We thankfully don't have that happen very often. A good majority of our legislatively named grants have been to the same organizations for a number of years, so they've worked through a lot of that already. But it does take some time, definitely, to work through what's a work plan based on the legislative language, based on the appropriations language, and what they want to do versus maybe what, you know, was the legislative intent. Again, we do, so sometimes that does happen. We don't get it, or it doesn't happen until late, as in, like, with the Tribal College Supplemental Grant. You know, they had 2 years, but now they only have, you know, 6 months or 8 months or 9 months. To do the work because it took us that long to get through the process. They do still have to go through if there's a requirement, you know, depending on the amount of the grant and things or who the grant is to. They may not have to go through a pre-award risk assessment, but most do. And if that's the case, it's the same as any other grantee. If there's issues identified either in the financial review or their previous grant experience or that lack thereof, you know, we have the requirement to put into place risk mitigation efforts, and then the legislative and statute language that at some point, you know, could allow us to not make the grant if we had to. We have not had that experience, but that's in statute now that allows us to do that if we were to have to. Correct.
And to that point, what would happen if you didn't get progress reports at all, or? I know of other state agencies that are not you, that I've heard from some whistleblowers, because I'm also on the Frog Committee, that other state agencies get progress reports in maybe 25% of the time, and when they do get them in, they don't look at them. So what would happen if one of these few legislatively named grants did not produce a progress report, or some of these other, like the pre-award risk assessment, that it didn't go well, you know, it was too high of a risk? Or, so what do you do in that situation, Ms. Fitzgibbons?
Chair, in terms of progress reports, we follow OGM policy as well as agency policy that if they have an outstanding progress report, they do not get any additional funds. Like I said earlier, a majority of all of our grants, including legislatively named grants, are on reimbursement. So that means they have to incur the expenses, they have to invoice us for those expenses, they have to provide supporting documentation as well as progress reports if they're due at that time. And we would not pay if their progress reports were due in, you know, very limited circumstances. I was not overseeing grants at the time, but I could understand perhaps maybe during the pandemic or some other like extenuating circumstances, the policies do allow for an agency to make those payments without, you know, with an exception. But I've never had to do that at our agency. But I could, you know, envision there could be some possible reason why you would do that. But in all circumstances, we just don't pay. And sometimes that means, I just approved a payment last week for one that the progress report was, you know, I think it was due in June. And they just finally got it to us, and we just finally paid the invoice that they sent to us in July. So, I mean, they just have to wait for the funds if they're not going to send the progress reports in.
I like that answer. Thank you. I'm sure Representative Robbins likes that answer, too, as we've been trying to figure out which state agencies like yourselves are doing such great work and small but mighty, I believe the commissioner has said before, so very appreciative of that answer. I think there was another question over here. Was it Representative Cleaborn?
Yes, thank you, but the question was answered. It was about the fact that the grants are on a reimbursement basis. Isn't that great to know?
We're just diving in deep here, Representative Cleaborn.
Chair, you made a statement that I just want to make some clarification about or just ask you if I heard you correctly. So on the student loan counseling page, when the question was asked about Lutheran Social Services being awarded the $388, did I hear you say that you had concerns because Lutheran Social Services was getting grants without oversight? Is that what I heard you say?
No, no. Okay. I'm glad you asked me that. Yeah. No. So in the legislative auditor report that we reviewed in Representative Robbins' committee, on page 7, in fact, of the grants management legislative auditor report, it lists about a dozen or so nonprofits that have received money through state agencies. And the state agencies don't really talk to each other, because I asked the legislative auditor, do they communicate back and forth about the grantees? And they do not. Some of it is prohibitive because of statute. But it had a listing in that report on page 7. It was the second paragraph down that said these different nonprofits receive more than receive money from more than one state agency. And Lutheran Social Services was the absolute top of the list at 10 agencies. Right. And those 10 agencies don't talk to each other about that grantee.
That was what I was referencing, the legislative auditor report. Okay, so I
heard
that, and then I did hear it. It was about 10 different agencies funding Lutheran Social Services, and you're saying they just don't communicate with each other, but you're not calling Lutheran Social Services into question, or are you?
No, I'm saying the process by which we do granting.
Got it.
Okay. Which is why I was very, very excited to hear how they handle grants and that they're following OGM, so the Office of Grants Management's policies. And they are small but mighty, but they are doing it correctly.
I totally agree. Oh, he does a great job. I just wanted to make sure I understood what you were saying. So thank you very much for the clarification. I appreciate it.
Okay. Any other questions before we move on? Okay. Back to the presentation.
Please.
I'm not even sure what page we're on, but you you might remember.
We are on the beginning of the next section, which is on the loan repayment programs administered at the agency.
And I actually was on that page, so we are good. Thank you, Ms. Fitzgibbon.
So the largest loan repayment program that we administer is the Shortage Loan Repayment Program. This program provides loan repayment assistance to teachers who are providing classroom instruction in Minnesota. The purpose of the program is to encourage teachers, particularly those that belong to a race or ethnicity underrepresented in the state's teacher workforce, to teach in Minnesota, or to teach in license shortage areas or teach in rural school districts. The FY24-25 biennial investment for this program was $1 million each year. The base for this program is $200,000 per year. Demand for this program remains high. In this last round of applications, we received over 1,350 applications. And even with our increased funding, we're only able to award 472 eligible teachers. The average award is $1,000, or 997. The max award is $1,000. We have four other loan repayment programs, first being a federally funded John R. Justice Student Loan Repayment Program. This provides loan repayment funds to public defenders and prosecutors in the state. The selected recipients do agree to serve either 1 to 3 years, depending on whether or not they've received it in the past, as a full-time prosecutor or public defender in the state. There are about 10 to 12 recipients each year. It kind of depends on if they're maintaining their service or not. And awards, depending on the federal funding that comes in, can be anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000 each year. We have an additional loan repayment program that supports agricultural education. This program, again, provides loan repayment assistance to teachers who are serving as ag educators in grades 5 through 12. They do sign a five-year service agreement in exchange for getting $3,000 each year for a total of $15,000 in loan repayment assistance. We also have an aviation degree loan repayment program. Similarly, this provides funds to pay down loan repayment or for loan repayment assistance for eligible pilots and aircraft technicians residing in Minnesota. The max is $15,000 per year for mechanics and $25,000 for pilots. And they do also agree to sign a five-year service obligation to serve full-time in that and serve Minnesota. We have a rural vet loan repayment program that supports veterinarians who either are in their first through third year of serving in Minnesota in designated rural areas in serving at least 50% of their service must be in the service of food animals, which for those not in agriculture, those are large animals, farming animals for food production and other sources. We do five recipients per year. They are awarded up to $75,000 depending on their outstanding debt and get $15,000 per year in over their five-year service obligation. And we do this in coordination with the University of Minnesota, so eligible recipients must be either about to be graduates or have graduated from the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine.
Madam Chair.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Thank you for discussing this. I just wondered, all of them seem to have a service obligation except the teacher shortage. Does that have a service obligation or not?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative, the teacher shortage loan repayment is written slightly different in the statute in that they are actually paid for their service in the previous academic year, but they can receive up to 5 years, five awards. So they can receive up to $5,000, but the way it's written in the statute, it actually doesn't have a service requirement. It has a, they're encouraged, I think it has a line about encouraged to continue to serve, but it's more of a did you serve in the previous academic year in the shortage areas or in a rural school district or met other shortage requirements.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So they're getting the award every year of college to repay the previous year's tuition or something, the loan?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative, no, this is for teachers who already have student loan debt.
Okay.
And they're serving as teachers. Some may also be going to school and also, incurring more debt, but they have existing, they have to provide documentation of their existing student loan debt as part of the application process, and then they receive funds that they then use to pay an eligible student loan, and then as required in statute, within 30 days they have to provide the Office of Higher Education documentation that they paid one of those eligible student loans with those funds. So it's not a financial aid program. They may also be students if they happen to also be in school, but it's for teachers who are serving and are considered borrowers at that point.
Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So they have to show that they've received their teacher's license, but they could be teaching in Wisconsin or Iowa or wherever while their loan is getting repaid.
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative, they have to have served in Minnesota in the previous academic year in a shortage area or meeting a shortage requirement in order to be eligible to apply. So they have to be licensed in Minnesota. They have to have a Tier 1 through 4 license. They have to have incurred debt. They have to have also served. And then we get verification from their employer through either PELSB and or actual employment verification from the school district or school that says, yes, this person taught, this is the subject they taught, this is what their assignment was. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Continue.
I'm going to hand this over to the other Megan in our agency, Megan Flores. Do you want me to do
Ms. Flores. Go ahead, Ms. Flores.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Megan Flores, and I am the manager for State Financial Aid Programs. So now we'll move to a little bit of talking a little bit more about financial aid. So we wanted to give a little bit of a kind of financial aid 101 to get us all on the same page about how financial aid works. It's definitely a topic that we get a lot of questions about. So in the state of Minnesota, there are two ways that a student applies for state financial aid programs. The majority of students file what is known as the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or the FAFSA. As many of you have heard from our previous testimony, the first day we were here, there were some challenges to the FAFSA this last cycle related to the FAFSA Simplification Act and the Future Act, two congressional acts at the federal level that were implemented last year. We were able to have quite a good success compared to a lot of our colleagues in other states and across the country. The Office of Higher Education partnered with many community nonprofits, including College Possible, Achieve Twin City, and ECMC, as well as our campus partners and high school partners, to increase and influence our FAFSA completion rate. We hosted several virtual workshops for families, and we have also been able to do some training or train-the-trainer types of events for our high school campus partners as well as community nonprofits. Nationally, the FAFSA rate was down for the class of 2024 by 9%. However, in Minnesota, we didn't fare quite as poorly as others. We were only down about 4.8%. We did see overall 11% of a FAFSA filing increase from the previous year. And that was also reflective in our enrollment rates. And so we saw about an 18,000 student net gain from fiscal year 24 to fiscal year 25, that first year of FAFSA implementation. Nationally, undergraduate enrollment was up about 4.5%. In Minnesota statewide, we are up 7.4%. And we were able to see growth across all sectors. And so with our nonprofit and public sectors, our public 2 years saw 11.5% enrollment increases. Our public 4 years saw 4.8% enrollment increases. And the private nonprofit sector saw 4.2% enrollment increases. So that's a little bit about the FAFSA. The second way that students of our state apply for financial aid is our state financial aid application. Less than 0.25% of those 256,000 Minnesotans who are enrolled in Minnesota apply using this state financial aid application. It was created in the year 2013 when the Minnesota Dream Act, otherwise known as the Prosperity Act, passed. And the intent for this application was that Minnesotans who are ineligible to complete the federal FAFSA form would have a way to apply for state financial aid. So students that apply for state financial aid through our state financial aid application include those who have asylum pending, H-4 visa status students, students who have temporary protective status, students who fall under deferred action for childhood arrivals, students who are undocumented but have attended a Minnesota high school for 3 full years and then either earn a GED or graduate from Minnesota high school with a diploma. And then if they are male as identified at birth, they are required to register for selective service. And then any other student who is legally present or lawfully residing and meeting a Minnesota residency definition but is ineligible to file the FAFSA. So those are the two ways students in our state apply for our state financial aid programs. When we look at that second way, where 0.25% of our students apply, a little bit more about that. In fiscal year 23, we had about 411 students who were awarded the Minnesota state grant via that application. Out of that 67,000 or so students that year, it was 0.6% of total state grant recipients. For the most recently completed fiscal year 24, we had about 506 students awarded via this application, and that was about 0.7% of all state grant recipients. When we look at this application as a way to apply for the newest program, the Minnesota North Star Promise Program, we had about 150 students, or about 0.03% of all North Star Promise recipients applied via the state financial aid application. When we look at financial aid programs, a few terms to kind of ground us. Sometimes you'll see in the programs that this body has created something called a first dollar program. That means that it is the first financial aid dollar applied to the student's financial aid offer. You'll also see the word last dollar, meaning that the program is the last financial aid dollar to be applied after all other financial aid that that student is eligible for is taken into consideration. So sometimes you'll see, for example, that it's the last dollar and it covers up to tuition and fees, or there might be other criteria like up to cost of attendance. These are really in the weeds kinds of terms, but they really do impact policy as well as implementation. Another status that you'll often see is the dependent student status. And in the financial aid world, when we refer to dependent students, we're not referring to the IRS federal tax code. We are referring to the way that the FAFSA, as well as our state financial aid application, refer to a dependent student. And that is that they are age 24 or under, excuse me, if they are under age 24, if they're not married, if they are not a veteran, if they're not a parent who's supporting their child over half of the time, if they're not an orphan or ward of the court or emancipated, and then all of that is regardless of how a parent claims someone on their tax return. So the way that a student is considered dependent for FAFSA purposes is different than the way someone is considered a dependent for tax purposes. That's probably the best summary statement or takeaway to offer. And then another terminology that you'll often see is the design for shared responsibility. And this is a model which our primary need-based financial aid program, the Minnesota State Grant, is built around. And that is the premise that to the extent they're able, students and families, as well as the government, all benefit from higher education and should all share a portion of the cost of that education. So now I'll move into talking a little bit about our state financial aid programs. The Fostering Independence Grant Program, this will be line 9 on your condensed budget worksheet. We are in the third year of an incredibly successful implementation for this program. This is a program that is a last dollar cost of attendance program and is designed for students who were in the foster care system. These are Minnesota residents who were in the Minnesota foster care system. And it's available to students who are under the age of 27 and experience foster care at any point in time after their 13th birthday. The program, as you can see here, we had about just under 500 students for the first year of the program. We had quite a bit of a jump the second year of the program. We are just around 500 students so far this year. And then with that jump that we had the second year of implementation, we did need to shift some money over from the North Star Promise program in order to hold students harmless. The American Indian Scholars Program, this will be line 32 on your condensed budget sheet. This program is actually administered directly on campus by our partnering schools, and so each campus defines their own process for how a student applies for the program. This is a first dollar tuition and fees program for eligible Minnesotans, and the students must be enrolled members or citizens of any federally recognized tribe or Canadian First Nation in order to qualify, and the dollars can only be used at our public colleges or universities in the state of Minnesota. We don't have full year data yet for this. We're still collecting that, but kind of some self-reported data we have received from our systems are that within the Minnesota state system, they've awarded about 400 students this award, and at the University of Minnesota campuses, 207 students. The Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program is our oldest state financial aid program, which was established in 1959, and this provides assistance to eligible Minnesotans who are enrolled members or citizens of a federally recognized American Indian tribe or Canadian First Nation who are a quarter or more American Indian ancestry. This grant is available, is available for both undergraduate as well as graduate students. However, the maximum amount of the award does vary a little bit depending on their program type. Typically, we award about $800,000 to $900,000 on the high end. Students for this award, the majority of these students do actually fall into enrollment at the private institutions at 53%, and then 38% at the Minnesota State System and 9% at the U of M for the fiscal year 2024. We did see a shift in that for this past fiscal year 24, where 59% were in the two-year programs, 24% at a four-year, and 17% at a graduate program.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, and I'm so sorry to interrupt your presentation, but in the Minnesota Indian Scholarship, are we still really measuring the one quarter or more ancestral heritage?
Madam Chair, Representative Cleburne, yes, we are.
How does
that is still a requirement.
Okay, so how does, Cleburne. Oh, I apologize, Chair. Sorry. So I'm trying to get my head around how that would work, right? And maybe this is a place where we need to think about revising it if we can, because this is very dear to me. 1959 was 65 years ago. That's two generations. So as you were, if you want to address this, I'll stop talking. But as you go through the generations, it's quite possible the one quarter, while you still may be living and involved and active in your culture, in your Indian heritage culture, the one quarter threshold may not still hold. So, but that's still very much your identity. Have there been plans to address this in any way? I mean, 1959, our thinking was very different. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. So Ms. Flores, do you want to try that or Ms. Fitzgibbon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I administered this program up until 2023 for the last since 2007. So the statute was changed in 2021, I think, legislative session, and actually encompassed some of what you're talking about. For most of the time since 1959, the requirement was they had to be one quarter or more. Or a member of a tribe, and actually, or one quarter or more. And in 2021, we were successful in getting a proposal through that expanded that definition to allow for members or citizens of a federally recognized tribes or Canadian First Nations. So we understand in Minnesota and in other areas, we have tribal nations who actually don't use blood quantum to determine their citizenship or membership within the tribe. But our statute at that point didn't recognize them unless they were able to provide documentation that had their blood quantum in it. And so we were able to encompass that within this the updated statute. The other thing I'd say is that within our statute, even though we and Commissioner Olson knows more about this than I do, understand that blood quantum is and can be a way to eliminate the existence of American Indians in Minnesota or at all. In this case, it actually provides a way for students who would not be eligible for other aid to be eligible because they can provide a combination of ancestry from multiple tribes to qualify for this scholarship. So those Minnesotans who are not able to be federally, a member or citizen of a federally recognized tribe because they don't meet that tribe or a tribe's requirement, which often by tribal constitution is one quarter or more ancestry. But if they have ancestry in multiple tribes and can get that documentation from the tribes that we as an agency can add up to one quarter or more, they can qualify for this scholarship. They wouldn't qualify for American Indian Scholars because American Indian Scholars requires membership in a tribe. They also wouldn't qualify for the tribal scholarship or other BIA funds that require membership. So in this case, it often does, and I don't have the numbers in front of me from this last year, but often that combination or those that qualify because they're not a member, makes up a good chunk of the numbers of students that get the Minnesota Indian Scholarship that wouldn't otherwise get other aid for this purpose.
Representative Cleaver.
And this is why we need department expert knowledge in all the work that we do. Thank you very much.
I couldn't agree more, Representative Cleaver. Thank you. This is a great, great agency, by the way. Like, they are 95 strong, small and mighty, and so I'm very appreciative for what they do.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Let's go back to
an important word "or" in there, right? Can be very important, those little tiny connector words in statutory language. So, yes. So our next program we're going to talk about is the Student Teacher Grant Program. This is another program we've been very excited to be able to share that for fiscal year 24, as well as the current fiscal year 25, every eligible student has received an award. So we're able to have enough resources as well as award everyone who's eligible for these programs. For the Student Teacher Grant Program, the shortage area is both a content area shortage as well as a location area shortage. So there's a couple of ways students can fall into that shortage area bucket that you see noted here with the fiscal year 24 and 25 amounts as well as the recipients. We're typically serving, you know, around 500 we have about 500 students apply. About 280 are actually eligible and then end up getting awarded the funds with an average award of just over $6,000. For the underrepresented student teacher bucket, we have also been able to award all of the recipients who are eligible, both last year in fiscal year 24 when we had about 130 recipients, as well as the current year when we're about on the same track with about 116 students receiving those awards. Oh, and just to mention, this program is for, it's on the slide, but just this is only available one time to a student, up to $7,500, and it's in the term that they're doing their required 12 weeks of student teaching. The next program we'll talk about is line 11 on your condensed budget sheet. This is the State Work Study Fund. This is a program that is available to both undergraduate as well as graduate students, and it provides either on or off campus employment jobs to help students pay for the cost of their higher education. Some of the positions can be structured into internships, and they could also be related to their field of study, both in the public and private sectors. Students do have to be Minnesota residents. If they are applying via our state financial aid application, they do have to show proof of work authorization. And then the students can be half-time or full-time, so it's a pretty flexible program. We typically have between 6,000 to 7,000 students, 8,000 students on the high end, that are receiving funds from this program with an average award between $1,500 to $2,000. Our next program, the Interstate Tuition Reciprocity Program, is line 52 on your condensed budget sheet. Minnesota has ongoing tuition reciprocity agreements with the state of Wisconsin, North Dakota, one community college in Iowa, and the Canadian province of Manitoba. What these agreements do is they provide a reduced non-resident tuition price, or sometimes even eliminate that non-resident admission barrier for students from Minnesota who attend one of these neighboring institutions, schools in one of these neighboring states. We did have a long-term agreement with the state of South Dakota. They recently ended that agreement with us in 2024. We do find out that 69% of reciprocity students that are Minnesota residents enrolled in those other states, those are our students, so they're flowing out, whereas we have about 31% of the students in this program are residents of other states that are enrolled here at our Minnesota Publics. We are currently working on a long-term study with this. We have recently found out that about 68% of Minnesota residents who leave the state 3 years later show up in our employment data here working in Minnesota, and about 36% of the students who come to Minnesota using that reciprocity benefit stay in Minnesota and show up in our employment records 3 years later. So we do see that the students are coming back to Minnesota the majority of the time, as well as we're capturing some of those out-of-state students and keeping them here, showing up working in Minnesota 3 years post-graduation.
Thank you. Representative Scott has a question.
Thank you. just wondering what happened with South Dakota, and then why only one institution in Iowa? If you could explain, like, what's the rub on these kind of agreements? What, you know, what makes it agreeable or not agreeable most often with other states?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So all of these agreements are one-to-one. So Minnesota to Wisconsin, Minnesota to North Dakota, Minnesota to South Dakota. No other state in the country has as many reciprocity agreements as we do, and they were very common in the late 70s. And it really was an agreement between whoever was the governor in each state at that point in time and who were the higher education leadership folks involved in those conversations. Iowa, there's a community college on the border, and it exchanges with a community college on the border in Minnesota. And so it's just very narrow in scope. The state of Iowa does not really want any students to ever leave. So they're not interested in a reciprocity agreement with us. South Dakota, that wasn't a very big reciprocity state for us. Overall, 80 to 90% of all reciprocity engagement happens between Minnesota, North Dakota, and Wisconsin. And again, North Dakota and Wisconsin don't have a relationship with each other. So it's Minnesota to North Dakota to Minnesota, Minnesota to Wisconsin, Wisconsin to Minnesota. South Dakota, I believe their biggest concern was related to not wanting their students to leave their state and come to Minnesota. I'm not sure, Commissioner Olson, you might have been involved in other conversations.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. Really, South Dakota ended their reciprocity agreements with all states that they held historical agreements with. They extended their in-state tuition rate. I'm struggling to come up with what it was called. I want to say South Dakota Promise. I know that's not correct.
Advantage.
South Dakota Advantage, thank you. They extended their in-state tuition rate to all, I believe, 11 other states, and that included Minnesota. So there was no longer a reason for an agreement.
Representative, okay, great. Thank you. Ms. Flores, continue.
You're welcome. The next program we'll talk about is the Public Safety Officer Survivor Grant Program. This program provides educational benefits to dependent children or the surviving spouse of a public safety officer killed in the line of duty after January 1st, 1973. The amount of the award is the lesser of the annual average full-time mandatory fees charged, tuition and mandatory fees charged by the institution, prorated for enrollment and for their term length and enrollment. And then the applicable tuition and fees maximum established for the state grant. So it's kind of doing a little bit of a comparison there. They do have to be enrolled students in an undergraduate degree or certificate program or a graduate program. And they have to be at an eligible Minnesota institution, which would include our public institutions. Students who receive these benefits can receive it for up to a maximum of 10 full-time semesters. We do not have a large amount of students who qualify for this. It's typically less than 10 students per year, with an average award between 7,000 to 9,000. Our next program is line 13 on your condensed budget sheet. This is the post-secondary child care grant program. This program helps low-income students who have young children pay for child care while the student is attending an eligible program. We typically see anywhere between 1,100 to 1,300 students participating with an average award, as you can see, they're about 5,400, 5,500 per year. The vast majority of these awards show up for students who are enrolled at our community and technical colleges. The next program you'll see on line 44 of your condensed budget sheet. This is the program for students with intellectual and developmental disabilities. This program is available for students who are attending a comprehensive transition program, a CTB program. In the state of Minnesota, we currently have three institutions who offer those programs: Bethel, Central Lakes, and Ridgewater. The money is shared between all of the eligible students per the aid year. So typically it's between 30 to 40 students who are receiving this. The most recent aid year we have data on, the award per student was about $5,600. This program won't actually show up on your budget sheet as it doesn't receive any appropriations, but we just wanted to mention that the state of Minnesota also has a self-loan program. It's available for Minnesota residents who are attending participating institutions in Minnesota, as well as participating institutions out of state, as well as non-residents who attend our Minnesota schools. The loan limits really are related to the cost of attendance, less other state financial aid or private or institutional federal aid, so anything that fits within the cost of attendance. Students can receive up to $40,000 per year for their baccalaureate and graduate programs, and then if they have shorter programs, such as 1 to 3 years in length, they can get $30,000 per year. We do about $60 million of loans per year, with about 5,700 loans, individual student loans. Now we'll move into talking about the Minnesota State Grant Program, which is line 6 on your condensed budget sheet. The Minnesota State Grant Program is our largest need-based state financial aid program, and it's meant to help Minnesota undergraduates pursue a degree at both public and private institutions in our state. Our most recent complete data set year of 2024, we had 71,530 recipients. The vast majority of the recipients are dependent students, and we have over 75 institutions in our state participating. The annual budget is $225 million, and the average award is about $3,400 per student. Half of all recipients of this program have an adjusted gross income of less than $40,000, and the vast majority end up at our Minnesota State institutions. We're going to forward a little bit to the North Star Promise slide that we have in here for you to talk about that. The North Star Promise program is our newest state financial aid program. You will see this as line 7 on your condensed budget sheet. This program has a base component as well as a plus component. The base component to North Star Promise is the tuition and fee-free promise. It is a last dollar program that covers uncovered tuition and fees. And then the plus component is an optional, as funds are available, component for students with the greatest financial need. For fiscal year 25, the current aid year, which is the first year of the program, that amount was set at 15% of the student's calculated Pell Award.
Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I slid a note to Ms. Flores to skip ahead to the North Star Promise slide. I know you at least wanted, us to kind of touch on the line item appropriation amount of it. You can see we obviously skipped about 20 slides of content that talks about the background of the state grant, the interaction between them. A lot of detail that we feel is critically important for the committee to be aware of, but feeling the time kind of work against us here, wanted to just check in with you to see if fine to go back or if you want us to kind of stop and take questions and then maybe look at a state grant deep dive at another hearing.
Yeah, let's do the state grant deep dive on another hearing because we've got about 20 minutes or so, and we do have another committee coming in right on top of us, so I don't have the luxury of going past our time, but if you want to continue on with this, and I do see we have a question, I'll get to you in just a second, Representative Coulter. We'll do the deeper dive on the state grant program just because we do have a massive deficit in it. We're all trying to figure out how to fill the hole. So I know you and I've talked about this on multiple occasions, and if we do it at the beginning of the committee hearing and we can kind of have that group discussion about some ideas to resolve it. I know you've got some policy pieces that you'd like to bring forward, and we should really have time to walk through those two and give them its full hearing on that as well. Okay, so we'll go to a couple questions, and then we'll go to the North Star Promise. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question actually came up for me as you were discussing the Fostering Independence Grant, but it works here as well. So Fostering Independence Grants, North Star Promise, and I know from my previous service on the Veterans Committee, state soldier assistance programs are all last dollar in. And if you've ever watched the Three Stooges, you know not everybody can be the last one in, or we all get stuck in the door. So I'm wondering how is that resolved? What, I mean, not everybody can be last, so how do you resolve when there are multiple last dollar in programs?
Commissioner Olson or Ms. Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Coulter. So, yes, this is true. We have been gifted multiple last dollar aid programs. Thank you. The way that that works is that federal law supersedes state law. So whenever there is a federal last dollar program, they indeed get to be the last dollar, the last dollar. For the state financial aid programs, we worked with the House as well as the Senate to pass some order of enactment language or aid calculation languages so that we could, for our financial aid colleagues on campuses, as well as for our students and our staff, and the technology that makes all of this work, create the what we needed to in guidance to be able to help fashion that. So the default is that it will fall to the order of enactment. So the oldest program that was a last dollar program will first pay, and then the next, and then the next, and then the next.
Good, Mr. Okay. You're good. All right, let's continue on then. Unless there's any other questions. No, I don't see any. Okay, Ms. Flores.
So the other information we have, if there aren't other questions, is just a little bit more about the North Star Promise to let you know. Again, this is a program that we have had. You heard my remarks about enrollment, where enrollment is at, and we hear pretty frequently from the public sector that direct admissions combined with North Star Promise has kind of been the leverage that we needed to change a 10-year enrollment trajectory. And for that, we do have the highest enrollment growth in the Midwest and one of those top five states in the country. The North Star Promise program, our first year, this is our first year of enacting this program. We're seeing just under 15,000 students this fall term. We just started paying out spring term over the last 2-3 weeks. So this is really fall term data. About just under 15,000 students receiving that base award, so that tuition and fee free last dollar program, and then about 40,000 students receiving that North Star Promise Plus award, which is really that 15% of the calculated Pell Grant. The combined of someone seeing both the benefit of the base award and the plus award is about 5,700 students. We are seeing that average amount of the award for the promise is about 1,800, and then for the plus award, it's about $376. Program flexibility, since we are running into some strain on this program as well, as you can imagine, with enrollment increases, and Madam Chair mentioned the state grant strain on resources, given the enrollment increases, we're seeing that within the North Star Promise program as well. So we're exploring the flexibility that we do have with an existing guidance and law, as well as kind of things that we can't change about the current situation. So a couple of those ideas here on the slide. And then I think, Commissioner Olson, do you want to wait to talk about this until maybe, I think because state grant and North Star Promise interplay so much, I think we'll pause on a deeper dive on North Star Promise until we have that state grant conversation when we're invited back.
Okay. Did you have, so are you done? You've concluded your presentation for the day?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Unless there are questions from any of the members.
Okay. Any other questions that weren't already answered along the way? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this. I look forward to the even deeper dive, but this has been super helpful, so I appreciate it. Regarding the North Star Promise Plus, I just wondered, did you set that 15% of the Pell Grant amount? And because you indicate there's flexibility there. And then secondly, are there any parameters around what that money is used for? Is it a reimbursement for housing or food or transportation or something? Or is it just, here's the money?
Ms. Flores.
Chair Representative Robbins. Yes, the percent is something that's in law for 3 years, and it's at the commissioner's discretion to set that amount based on available program funds. And so that's set year by year. So we set that at 15% for this first year of the program. We've already shared with our campus partners that that match for next year will be 0% based on the constraints on the program. As far as what the funding can be spent on, one term I'm realizing I probably should have had in that, you know, get you ready to have this conversation introductory slides was cost of attendance. The cost of attendance is something that you'll often hear folks in the financial aid world talk about. Each institution sets their own cost of attendance, and that's used for federal, state, institutional, and all financial aid programs. And really, a student can't receive more aid than the cost of attendance at their institution. That cost of attendance includes direct expenses like tuition and fees that they pay to the school, as well as an allowance for housing, food, transportation. It can include the cost of a documented disability or childcare, and it can include the cost of a first-time computer purchase or professional licensing fees. And so as long as that aid is within the cost of attendance, the student can receive those funds. When you asked your question about the North Star Promise Plus, that can be used for any of the expenses within the cost of attendance. Since those students have their tuition and fees covered and that average award is about $376, in all likelihood, that's probably going towards books or housing or maybe a parking permit, could be food while on campus. But there isn't a process where the student needs to show those expenses, because it has to fit within the cost of attendance. So we know that those funds are being used on something related to their higher education.
Representative Robbins. Okay. So just to be clear, though, it doesn't have to be, it's not a reimbursement like you're talking about with the grants. It's just they have to be under the cap of cost of attendance. So they could technically take it and do something else with it other than pay for their room and board. Ms. Flores.
Yep. Madam Chair, it does have to fit with the cost of attendance. So if the student already has aid that goes up to the cost of attendance, the financial aid office would have to reduce a loan, reduce work study to make that fit so that the student could receive the funds. If the student, for example, had on-campus housing or a meal plan, the student wouldn't receive a refund check for that $376. It would just help pay the bill.
Okay, thank you. All right, any other final questions from members? Okay, seeing none, we will have you back again. We'll do a deeper dive yet on state grant and how that works with North Star Promise and North Star Promise Plus. But for right now, we are adjourned. Thank you.